Hi, and welcome to Intern Ready OBGYN, a podcast aimed at helping you excel during your intern year in OBGYN. My name is Dr. Lucy Brown. I'm a resident at Johns Hopkins and your host for Intern Ready OBGYN. Hello, and welcome back to Intern Ready. My name is Lucy Brown, and I'm joined today by Dr. Mahima Krishnamoorthy to discuss hysteroscopy, your first hysteroscopy in the OR. So, Mahima, what are our learning goals for today?
Yeah, so our learning goals are to review the indications for why someone might get a hysteroscopy. We'll discuss the important tips for pre-op preparation and chart review and what to talk to a patient about beforehand. We'll discuss appropriate OR setup, the relevant equipment and procedural steps. We'll touch a little bit on fluid distension media, and then we'll review the common complications.
Awesome. So starting from the top, why is somebody getting a hysteroscopy in the first place? What are the indications?
Yeah, so there are two big categories for hysteroscopies. There are diagnostic hysteroscopies and operative hysteroscopies. A diagnostic hysteroscopy could be done for many reasons. Most commonly is for some form of abnormal uterine bleeding or postmenopausal bleeding, although it could also be used for an infertility workup or abnormal imaging findings. An operative hysteroscopy is kind of under the umbrella of a diagnostic hysteroscopy because it's usually done after a diagnostic hysteroscopy is completed. But this allows us to address anything that we see on the hysteroscope. So if there's a polyp, we can remove it. A myomectomy, usually with submucosal fibroids, can be done hysteroscopically. A septum resection for infertility workup, lysis of adhesions, foreign body removal, so an IUD that's difficult to get out, things like that. Hysteroscopies can be done in the OR, but they can also be done in the office. We'll primarily be discussing what it's like as an intern to be in a hysteroscopy that's done in the OR.
Great. And so when you are preparing for your first case, what is on your pre-op checklist? What are you doing for chart review?
Yeah, definitely. So the things that I look up beforehand are, you know, one, why is this patient even getting the hysteroscopy? So I look at previous clinic visits and try to understand what their indication is. The other thing I always make sure to check is whatever imaging they've had done. So whether that's a transvaginal ultrasound or an MRI, I'm specifically looking for two things. One, what is the size of the uterus? I want to know this because when I'm dilating, I want to know in my head how far out the fundus is because I don't want to dilate past what I know is already listed on the imaging as the measurement. And then I also want to look for any location of focal areas of pathology. Mm-hmm. That way I can kind of know where to direct my hysteroscope in the OR. The other things I'm looking up are any medical comorbidities. So do they have any cardiac, renal, pulmonary disease? This is really important in a hysteroscopy because for folks that are more sensitive to fluid shifts in the body, it helps you determine whether or not you have a lower fluid management threshold mm-hmm. for them. And then if they've had prior cervical procedures or risk factors for stenosis, especially having, being postmenopausal, I think about that as well in terms of knowing that it might be a little bit more difficult to dilate them. And then lastly, if this is in the chart or if it's something I can just ask them before going back to the OR, it's nice to know where they are in their menstrual cycle, especially for a premenopausal woman. If they are presenting and they are actively on their period, it can make visualization during hysteroscopy very difficult.
So how are you talking to a patient in the pre-op area or in clinic prior to the procedure about what is going to happen?
Yeah, so I tell patients that we'll be doing a hysteroscopy, which is using a thin instrument that's almost like a telescope mm-hmm. to look through the vagina into the cervix and then into the uterus. It gives us a much better look into what's going on into their uterus. The benefits are we can get usually very good diagnostic sampling, as well as if there is a polyp or a submucosal fibroid, being able to do sort of a therapeutic, you know, addressing their symptoms. Yeah. And then in terms of risks, you know, as we would for any surgery, we think about pain, bleeding, infection. All of those are fairly low risk in a hysteroscopy. The other more unique risks that we think about are things like uterine perforation. Mm-hmm. This can happen often when someone is getting dilated, especially if someone has cervical stenosis. Mm-hmm. You can think about them being at a higher risk for that. you tell patients, of course, that if they do have a perforation, that sometimes nothing else actually needs to be done, that it can heal on their own. But there is always the risk that we would need to make smaller incisions in their belly and look down with a camera from up top in order to look deeper.
Great. So what are the components of a hysteroscope?
Yeah, so there are a few components of a hysteroscope. Obviously, it will be a lot easier for you to understand when you're looking at a hysteroscope. Mm-hmm. So my biggest tip before I go into all of these is to, when you're in the OR, you can even try to go to the OR a little early and see if your scrub tech will show you how to put the hysteroscope together so that you're a little more familiar with all the parts. But in big picture, the components of a hysteroscope are, one, the actual telescope. So this is the inner component that has the actual lens. There are a few different types of viewing angles that you can do. So you'll sometimes hear your attending call for a 0 degree or a 30 degree. This just gives you a different angle with the telescope. So a 0 degree is forward viewing. So where you're pointing is pretty much exactly where the camera or the telescope is viewing. A 30 degree has a little bit more of a lateral view. And mm-hmm. so sometimes people will use that for more difficult angles or corners that require a little bit more maneuvering to be able to see. The other parts of the hysteroscope include an outer sheath that sort of houses the telescope, an inflow and outflow port. So the inflow port is where the fluid delivery system, usually normal saline, will drain in to the hysteroscope. And then the outflow port is obviously where it comes back out. Mm-hmm. Be prepared to get wet during a hysteroscopy because it's always the case that the inflow and outflow port have moments of just dysfunction and it will just get everywhere.
Yep.
As best as you can to use under the butt drape to be able to catch all of the fluid as it's coming out can be super helpful for your scrub techs and your attending to make sure that we are calculating the amount of fluid that comes in and out of the hysteroscope correctly. The other parts include the light source. When you're putting it together, you'll hear this plenty of times in the OR. Make sure to keep the actual light source away from the drapes, away from the patient's body mm-hmm. as best as you can because it is very, very hot. Mm-hmm. And then the camera system, which is where you're actually able to see the images on a video monitor. And then usually for an operative scope, you'll have like a working channel where you can place things like graspers, scissors, when you want to go from a diagnostic hysteroscope to an operative. That's kind of big picture. There are a lot of different types of hysteroscopes, which we won't get into. But like I said before, as best as you can to try to get some practice putting together the hysteroscope will be the best opportunity to really know what all of the working pieces are.
Yeah, our scrub techs are so excellent. And oftentimes they will just put it together for you. And in the beginning, I would have to ask them to not do that so
Definitely.
That I could get experience. And I'll make sure to put in the show notes like pictures of all these like different components.
Great.
All right. So let's move on to what kind of fluid we typically use. And the most commonly, just like Mahima said, we're using normal saline, but there are situations where we may use different fluid, different types of fluid. So we can kind of review some of those.
Yeah. So for distension with a hysteroscope, we're essentially using some kind of media in order to, similarly with a laparoscopic surgery, using air to mm-hmm. be able to inflate the abdomen. We want some kind of medium that allows the uterus to sort of inflate from inside. Previously, there was historically use of carbon dioxide, but that's sort of not been used as much just because it can increase in like shoulder tip pain and increased risk of gas embolism. Now, most commonly, like Lucy said, we use isotonic solutions. So normal saline is the most commonly used. It's really the preferred distension media. Mm-hmm. The advantages of this, it of course is isotonic, so it has the same osmolality and sodium concentration as blood. It's also compatible with bipolar electrosurgery. So whenever you're using any kind of bipolar energy, the normal saline is really what you'll want to be able to use. There are other types of distension media, so like things like hypotonic solution, so 1.5% glycine, 3% sorbitol, 5% mannitol. This is really used when you need to use monopolar surgery because it's non-conductive. It doesn't have those ions running through it, but it does have a much lower safe amount that you can use. Mm-hmm. You'll hear your attendings talk a lot about the fluid deficit. That was always really confusing to me as an intern to even know what that really meant.
Yes.
So what that means is when you are placing fluid into the uterus, obviously there you would hope that all of the fluid comes back out because you don't really want it to sit in the uterus because then it can move out through the fallopian tubes and kind of then start to sit in the belly.
Like extravasate, essentially.
Yes, exactly. But you're never going to get a 100% in and out. There's always going to be some amount that goes into the belly and extravasates out. But your goal in a hysteroscopy is to try to limit that amount as much as possible. And so that deficit is the sort of subtracted amount of fluid that is sort of extravasating out that you're constantly keeping track of. And so ACOG kind of has a maximum fluid deficit that they recommend. For isotonic solutions, it's actually up to like 2.5 liters per ACOG. I will say I feel like most attendings won't really go up to that amount. They'll start to get a little nervous as you get closer to like 1.5 liters. So that obviously just depends on your attending and their preference. For patients with HAV that have like comorbidities or elderly patients who have bigger sensitivities to giant fluid shifts, you might even see people stop at like 750 cc's or a liter just so that they can ensure that they don't have an excessive fluid shift that they won't tolerate.
So hysteroscopy is generally very, very safe. However, there are some complications. Let's go through those. What are some common and less common complications of hysteroscopy?
Yeah, so we can talk a little bit about going from outside to the inside as you're thinking about what complications are. So from the kind of start of hysteroscopy, when you're just starting to place your speculum, place your tenaculum, the things that we think about are one, of course, infection. It's rare, actually, with proper technique. Usually in a hysteroscopy, we're not using antibiotic prophylaxis.
Right.
And that's because everything is sort of contained in that sort of non-sterile space that you're in when you're performing a hysteroscopy. But that's always something you think about. The other things are things like a vasovagal reaction. Usually our anesthesia colleagues are managing this a little bit more, but that sometimes can happen with the fluid distention that's done in a hysteroscopy. Otherwise, when you're placing a tenaculum or using your lidocaine or any other instruments that are going around the cervix, you always want to be aware of any types of cervical lacerations. Mm-hmm. Excessive dilation especially can be a trigger for this. The reason why it's important is because anyone who's seen a cervical lac knows just how much they can bleed. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, you want to control the bleeding, but also it's going to be impossible to see anything with your hysteroscope. And so you might need to repair with sutures if that is fairly significant.
Yeah. And one trick that I was told as an intern was like, don't take a baby bite with the tenaculum because that's going to be more likely to tear. I feel like I was always so nervous to take a big bite of the anterior lip of the cervix. But, you know, if you have a good visualization, get a decent bite so that it does not tear.
Yeah. I think that's a really good tip. Otherwise, of course, anytime we're doing any kind of instrumentation in the uterus, we think about our concern for a hemorrhage and the risk of that. It's less common in a diagnostic hysteroscopy, but in an operative hysteroscopy, especially when you're going after something like a submucosal fibroid, it can be in up to 3% of cases. You think about what you do for hemorrhage in like a postpartum in a delivery, kind of the same things. You try uterine massage, you try uterotonics, and then if it's really severe and it needs some kind of tamponade, you can place things like an intrauterine balloon. Once you're actually doing the hysteroscopy, the complications that you're always going to want to be aware of and that your attendings are going to be aware of while you're there is one, uterine perforation. I think this was the one I was always the most nervous about as an intern, and I'm still nervous about. Half of them are related to dilation and just actually trying to enter into the uterus. So sometimes when patients have like suprastenotic cervices and you're trying to get a dilator through, if you feel a lot of tension and you don't feel comfortable, it's completely understandable to ask your attending or senior to kind of try for you. I think I did that many times as an intern just to kind of understand how much force to really give. And it's hard to know that as an intern because you're always going to give less force.
Yeah. And honestly, we probably perf more than we even know, even with our non-hysteroscopy dilation procedures. And ultimately, everybody will do it. And it most often feels like kind of a loss of resistance. Like you go in and then you just, oof, you're just in like air. And that often means you're in the belly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Some attendings will have you dilate with the mechanical dilators. Some of them will, in a hysteroscopy, just ask you to dilate with the fluid. And mm-hmm. so you'll actually just place the hysteroscope and then open up your fluid and kind of hydrodilate, mm-hmm. where you'll use the pressure of the fluid to slowly dilate the cervix. And a lot of attendings like that because it gives you a little bit more visualization. Of course, if you were to perf with any kind of energy, that is a lot more of a serious complication, one in which you likely have to do some kind of laparoscopy to rule out bowel injury. Mm-hmm. And then we touched on this a little bit with fluid management, but fluid overload is really that unique consideration in a hysteroscopy. And so you're always keeping an eye out on your maximum deficit, thinking about what comorbidities your patient has. You'll always notice your attending or senior ask the anesthesia team, what is our patient's mean arterial pressure? What's our patient's MAP? And then we'll place the pressure for the hysteroscope, the fluid, lower than mm-hmm. that, because we want to limit the amount of fluid that, based on pressure differentials, would move outside of that system.
Right. Moving pressure from high pressure system to a low pressure system.
Exactly.
So your pressure inside the uterus, you don't want that higher than the pressure in the rest of your body.
Right. If you're starting to approach the maximum deficit and worried about the effects on the patient, sometimes you can just stop the procedure. Mm-hmm. Some attendings could recommend treating with diuretics. Mm-hmm. Of course, the things that you want to check for afterwards are to make sure that you get a CMP to ensure that the patient's sodium is okay, all of their electrolytes. But that's one of the main things that you want mm-hmm. to check for.
The last thing I will mention is pulmonary edema, like flash pulmonary edema. We had a patient my intern year, the fluids were like kind of wonky on the fluid management system. And we were like, God, there's something wrong with the machine. It's not us. And it turns out we had perfed, and the whole time it was just going into the belly, and the patient got flash pulmonary edema and she had to stay overnight. She ended up recovering just fine. But it is something to think about, you know, being very cognizant of when the machine is wonky, don't keep going.
Yeah.
Maybe pause and reevaluate and make sure you haven't perforated.
Definitely. Lastly, we think about those sort of like rare but very serious complications. This is a little bit more common with CO2 as a distension media, but gas embolism mm-hmm. is something that you want to be aware of. Similarly, obviously, with fluid overload, if you're using CO2, that gas can escape and extravasate out. And so that's something to be aware of. And then thinking about how fluid overload can affect the body in terms of potentials for shock, so like a distributive shock picture in the setting of sepsis, and then, of course, death. So when you're thinking about the complications, of course, you're thinking about them in the context of, you know, when you're actually doing the procedure, but it's also important to mention all of these to patients when they are being counseled.
Yeah. Super rare, but definitely very serious. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Mahima. This was excellent.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Intern Ready OBGYN. We hope you found today's podcast helpful. Don't forget to subscribe below, rate the podcast, leave a review, or suggest a new episode.